listening to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio is supported by Compass, the future of real estate in the Metro DC area and beyond. Discover more at compass.com.
Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Welcome to the Dorchesa Sherbert Experience on Full Service Radio. We're broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I am your host, Violeta Edelman, and I'm here with my co-host and husband,
Rob Duncan, co-owner Dorchesa, along with Violeta.
We are gelato makers. We have 10 locations in Washington, D.C. We make gelato every day in our factory in Union Market. And we're here today with our friend Spike Mendelson. Spike is a well-known chef, food advocate, and television personality. You have a lot going on, my dear.
Yes, lots going on.
Welcome, Spike, and thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I love your guys' gelato.
Well, thank you.
It's delicious.
Black and white shake, baby.
Black and white shake.
That's what it's all about.
We go way back.
We go way back. Which is always a good thing. So talking about going way back, I wanted to start with your beginnings in food. So what's your first memory of falling in love with food? way back.
Well, interestingly enough, you know, I unfortunately didn't have the liberty to fall in love with food. I was thrown into the dish pit, you know, in a family full of restaurateurs based out of Montreal. I didn't really have a choice. I actually hated the restaurant business growing up, and I did not want to become a chef. I didn't want, you know, you worked holidays, you worked weekends. I saw my parents just working all these crazy hours. It's kind of like the last thing you wanted to do. But I was always a foodie. You know, my mother always cooked great, delicious food. So I always appreciated cooking and flavors and all that kind of jazz. I don't think there's like that one moment where I was like, I had like this duck a l'orange and I was like, this is what I want to do. I never had that moment, so
that's okay. Yeah. I like the, you know, life.
Many paths.
It's what happens to you when you're busy making other plans.
Yeah,
it's John Lennon.
Yes, exactly.
So, for sure.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about this family business. I hope that's not what happens to our children, because I could see Pema saying, "I hate gelato.
Fuck this."
Well, listen, they're never going to grow up like wanting to do it. Yeah, maybe, but like.
I always felt mostly. Like the good thing about having a family business is that you have this hands-on experience working when you're a little kid, or at least like approaching that sort of, you know, working environment. And although you probably, you know, didn't like it at the time, I'm sure that was important, informative, you know. Did you feel like you gained
absolutely.
Like work ethic and, you know, like life
listen,
is tough and
yeah,
I have to dish, you know, be a dishwasher or whatever you were doing. Tell me what you were doing
at
the time
you thought it was like the most horrible thing to have to like work for your parents in a restaurant run. Your friends are jet skiing on the weekends or doing.
This was in Florida?
This was in Florida.
Okay,
this was about at Pepin's. It was a fine dining Spanish restaurant that my parents had. And but then it was kind of cool because the whole time I was so young that the entire kitchen crew just treated me as one of their own. So I would get like all like the gossip inside and scoop of all the employees, you know. Working the stations, they just didn't treat me like a family member, actually. It was kind of cool.
How old were you when you were in?
So I was like 12, I think, you know, anywhere from 10 to 12 years old. I was, you know, I remember I had this vivid moment where I was a dishwasher, right? And the waiters would come in with all this leftover food and just dump it, right? And, you know, my challenge would, like, my game would be is, like, how fast can I get all these dishes through the machine and, like, take the window wiper and scoop all that gross leftover stuff into the hole? And that was, like, my thing. And, like how good and efficient I can do this. Like, that was just, like, I loved that kind of challenge. And then there was, like, this Armenian monster of a guy that was working the dish pit with me. And his favorite game was to do that, you know, that slap game. I swear, oh, yeah. He must have been like a 32-year-old man, right? Like,
so the maybe, slaps were like hardcore? Like,
oh my God.
Bleeding.
My knuckles, right? And like, you have to imagine, like, I was also like working like a high temp dishwasher, right? And
like, you, I think, wonder why you don't like food, my dear.
Right. I keep thinking back. I was like, did he do that on purpose? Because he knew I was like the son's owner. And he was like, I don't know what it was, but like, I felt like we were best friends. But yeah, every night I'd leave with swollen hands because, like, in between, like, the wash, he'd want to play this game. And that's,
at least it wasn't bloody knuckles where he's thumping your ass.
Oh, no. You know, like, yeah. Dude, he had a hard whack. It was like, well, yeah.
You know, Rob was a janitor when you were, like, four or five years old.
I was cleaning bathrooms, toilets, vacuuming rooms when I was 5 years old. Started working, and I was so... And my dad was the custodian of the middle school because he was a high school teacher that didn't earn anything.
Yeah.
Mom was stay-at-home mom, so yeah.
I
started working.
And
work
I hop on a city bus when I was 16 and sold stuff.
Yeah.
And I think about our kids and I think that, you know, they're probably not going to go through stuff like that. And I'm glad on a way, but on the other hand, I'm not. Because yeah. I feel like that was so important. That shaped me.
Yeah,
like,
work ethic now.
Yeah,
it's very different from what it was in our time, and obviously before that with our parents and grandparents, it's changed a lot.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, to answer the question, I look back on those times as like bittersweet because now I'm older and I look back on them like, man, that really shaped me to who I am. It gave me incredible creds as street smarts, you know, just like learning that restaurant subculture of life, like from a young age, you know, where you're exposed to it rather than you graduate from college, you get thrown into the real world and you're like, whoa, like, wait a second. So like, I felt like it really shaped me and prepared me for like everything I'm doing right now. So I have no regrets. And I'm going to try as hard to put my kid through that same aspect, you know, like, you know, he's probably going to work in a restaurant.
Oh, I've talked about toilet cleanup day at home once a week at least for our kids just to learn. Like,
it's going to be something, right? You're going to have to, like, you know, we have to figure out something.
Hard work. The work ethic is so important.
Oh yeah,
in general.
Oh yeah,
for everything.
So, how did your life continue after Florida? What did you do? Is it true that you went to France to work at Chateaus, or is just that an internet rumor?
No. I update my own wiki page, so I put, you know. Currently, I'm a three Michelin star chef on wiki. You know.
And you won an Oscar, and then what else?
Fake it till you make it, right?
Yeah.
My LinkedIn says I'm an actor. You know. I play chef, so
the legends.
Yeah, you know, you just gotta, you know, just believe it, put it out there. I did. So, you know, funny story about my mother always told me if I wanted to be a serious chef growing up, I would have to go work at this one place called Les Crayères in the north of France. It means chalk caves where champagne is riddled and kept. And she had been there. She had dropped my father and her were on honeymoon, and they got stuck in the north of France, and they had nowhere to stay. And the only place that had it available was this chateau. And they pulled up in a shitty little Renault like car with their baggage, filthy, and they were completely embarrassed. But the host was Gerard Boyer and his wife, and they ran this amazing 19 room three Michelin star restaurant for 20 years. And they dined there. They had the most incredible experience. They brought back signed menus. And I always grew up looking at these famous menus from all over the world because my mother was like a huge foodie and an amazing chef. And they traveled everywhere. But Gerard Boyer's was one that I always like took in particular. Like, I was like, man, like, I love this place. So when I was in culinary school, you had to get an externship, right, at the CIA. And I used to stay up until 3 a.m. to call the chateau asking them to accept my externship because you got to get it, like, you know, you got to get the check mark and get it approved and everything. And I swear, like, I would call, like, maybe at 3 a.m. my time would be like early in the morning in France over there, and they would answer the phone, and I'd be like, it'd be like, ah, oh, l'Américain is calling again, right? And they would refuse my externship like week after week after week until maybe like the seventh month. Finally, I called, and he's like, putain, like,
stop it,
stop it, leave us alone. I'll send it to you. So. I got accepted very late in the school period, and I went there, and I didn't come back to school. I was having such a good time that I did. So I went and worked at Le Carrière as part of the Brigade, and they ran me through every station, and it was by far the greatest experience I've ever had in my life. So explain
to people the French chateau tradition and obsession with Michelin stars and the level of impeccable food and service and what they live and die for.
Sure. I mean, in France, food is everything, right? It's more, you know, chefs are more important than the prime minister. They're more important than the government. They're really the superstars, right? I mean, you look at guys like Alain Ducasse, Paul Bocuse, you know, restaurants like La Pyramide and all these great gods, the foundation of cuisine, really, if you look at it, you know, it all came from France. So these guys are highly regarded, and the Michelin star really dictates the success that you're having within the industry. And you go into restaurants like Gérard Boyer's at Le Carrière, and it's, you know, it's a 60-man operation, right? For, you know, a 45-seat, you know, restaurant.
And how do they make money?
I don't know if they do. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. But they take, you know, it was a silent kitchen, and you have a brigade, right? Which is pretty much a piano. It's like soldiers on the meat station and the saucier station and the fish station and garde manger. And in each station, you have like five positions. It starts with the saucier, the sous chef, and the commis, and you just have to work your way up. But it takes it, you know, it's kind of a ballet. You know, the way those kitchens work, were very much, they were silent. Everybody knew what they were doing. Everybody kind of had to be on rhythm, and everything would meet up at the front. It was a beautiful thing to be part of at a young age and be exposed.
Is that still strong as far as in the chateaus?
Yeah,
in
that's
France,
still.
Or is it changing at all?
That's still strong in the chateaus more than ever. You know, what I feel we're experiencing in France right now is we're the second coming of the world-renowned chefs, where you're having these chefs that are like, you know, between the ages of 30 and 45 that have been training under these great chefs, and now they're starting to make their name. You know, even at Le Carrière, you know, right now is an amazing chef is coming up the ranks up there and making a name for himself. So
the next generation.
Yeah, next generation. You even see it in a little Washington, you know, still that flavor of seriousness in the kitchen and respect for the brigade system. But I, you know, but even it doesn't even, it not only happens on a fine dining level. Like, I remember the pastry chef was this guy named Romain, and he invited me for dinner to his village in France. Right. And I this was the best experience ever. Like, went to the village, maybe 1,000 people lived there, and dinner was from around the village. You know, you had like the bread that was baked, the milk that was milked across the street that was made, turned into cheese. You had the champagne from the vineyards. You had the cut de boeuf that we cooked like on the open fire pit. It was just like everything from right around there. Like, it was, you know, that's how much they appreciate food. It's like always a story. Like, hey, this came from there, you know?
You know, Bialetta's father lives in Italy, and they say the same thing. It's like the neighbors come over with the olive oil from their cousin that has a whatever olive farm, and they press the olives to get the oil. It seems like outside of here, and definitely going back in the past, that's just the way that it was everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's good to know that it's still preserved somewhere.
Yeah.
It's definitely not that way here.
Yeah. I mean, you're starting to see a little bit of that.
There's
here,
a comeback,
you know,
for sure, yeah, with the maker. But I'm just saying the whole post-World War II industrialization of all food into supermarkets, you know, that changed everything here.
100%.
Guys, I think we're going to take a quick break. Oh. But I want to remind everyone that you are listening to the Dolcezza Server Experience on Full Service Radio, and we're broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C.
All the original music you're hearing today is by Flash Frequency, D.C. native, also host of Leaf Broadcast here Thursdays at 6. This is the Dolcezza Sherbert Experience, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back, guys, to the Dolcezza Sherbert Experience on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. This is Violeta Edelman. I'm here with Rob Duncan. We are owners of Dolcezza Gelato, and we're here with celebrity chef Spike Mendelsohn. Yo, that was my spiel.
Celebrity chef.
Celebrity chef.
We can talk about that celebrity.
I'm a D-lister, goddammit.
Well, we got to talk about Top Chef.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So when did you decide to participate, and how was the process?
Wide open.
Oh, my God. I have this answer.
You go way back, by the way.
Memorized.
Go, like, this is the
bumper
beginning.
Sticker.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry I'm asking you about this.
No, no,
I know,
I don't
like,
care.
It's like the question that they ask me, and Rob is like, oh, how did you have the idea of making gelato? And
yeah, it make it quick, like, so we can talk about other shit.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, you know, I met Andy Cohen. We hugged it out. He told me to get on Top Chef. I did. I won, and that's it.
Right. Easy peasy.
Yeah,
thank
no,
you very much.
No,
have a good
for the record, I've lost every cooking competition show I've ever been on. So, but winning in life, right? Like, so
what is winning anyway?
Yeah,
right?
What is winning? You don't want to win.
No.
Too much attention on you.
Fuck the winners.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like the losers.
Yeah.
The stories are better.
A lot more lessons.
They smoke the best weed.
There's a lot more lessons to be learned as a loser.
100%.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah. And we do smoke the best weed.
100%. That's one thing as far as, like, I always remember. I think, I don't, maybe it's not true, but I think where I met you was like in the back of one of the food events here in D.C., packing a bowl and smoking with Spike. And it was like, and then since then, every single event, I always look for Spike and go out back and smoke.
Look, just find the dumpster. I'll be right next to it. around there. But not in D.C. because it's legal.
Illegal. Ooh. No worries. Yeah.
So,
Jeff Sessions.
Top Chef, right. Yeah. Sorry.
It's okay.
I did Top Chef Chicago. I actually tried out for Top Chef 3.
Uh-huh.
My sister was a fan of Project Runway, and she'd watch the chef after. So I got, for a year, I got nonstop. She's like, you have to be on the show.
Make it work. What he always said.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, Fido C.
I said
one day my Spanish version.
One day you're in, one day you're out.
Heidi.
So, yeah, such a great tagline. So I applied for Top Chef 3. I submitted a video. I was working for Drew in Tribeca at the time, Drew Nipperant. I had a Vietnamese restaurant called My House over there. So my boys helped me do like this little production video of like what I do. And we just had fun with it. So my video was, I got a live eel. And so it started with me wrestling an eel, like to fabricate a live one. So
of course.
There's, you know, and then
National Geographic.
Yeah, National Geographic. Yeah, it was like, you know, downstairs in Tribeca kitchen, and this eel like got the better of me. Let me tell you, like, that is a pretty difficult thing. And then I went into, you know, I bought this really in Chinatown off of Mulberry Street. I bought this massive Chilean sea bass and a samurai sword. And I went into like from an eel to like, you know, I'm pretty good at fabrication, so I fabricated this, like, you know, this massive fish with a samurai sword, like, really quickly, flipped it to the other side, and then I had my buddies, like, throw watermelons at me, like, literally, you know.
I gotta see this video.
Fruit ninja.
I
want
to hire you.
Yeah. And then I ran upstairs and cooked, like, five dishes really quickly. And
is this on YouTube?
I don't think, though, you know what, they keep all the videos,
of
so you can't even get,
life,
you can't get any of the footage back from them. they own you. I should try to get that video though. That would be great. But anyways, long story short, they flew me to LA as the last 30, and when I flew back, I landed back in DC, and they had told me I didn't make the show, and I got real pissed because I was like, what? Me? Did you see what I did on that video? So my contact had been Andy Cohen at the time, and I emailed them back. I was like, your show is going to go up in flames. It sucks.
I'm coming you with the samurai.
You passed on me.
Samurai. So
yeah, like, I can't believe you, fuck right? It. Send. Very emotional email. And 6 months later, I get a reply back to that email from Andy. He's like, hey, really like what you did on your video. Would love to have you for season 4. And I was like, damn.
You're persistent.
I am.
This goes back to your story of, you know, calling the chateau. Yeah.
I always tell people, like, no's were avenues to a big fat yes. That's my motto. Like, just, you know, you're getting somewhere. When people are saying no to you, you're going places. So yeah. That's the way I feel, I guess. Sounds weird, but
it works.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the door opened for you.
That season 4, that it was Mike Isabella also was a.
No,
that with you?
No, he came on. He came afterwards. So season 4 was a pretty stacked season. It was Dale Talday,
Fabio.
No, was he on his season? No, he wasn't on his season. So it was not. He's great though, but it was.
But he wasn't on season 4.
No, he wasn't. It was Stephanie Izzard, which won, and she's a rock star right now. Richard Blaze, he's doing
Richard
his thing.
Blaise,
Dale Talday, Andrew Demprosi, Antonio Lufthansa, me. A handful of other people that got voted off early, and that's it.
losers.
Who are those losers?
It's the we were the losers.
But yeah. Have you ever thought about doing anything competitive? Like, you feel like that's your nature? Like,
no, it's not my nature.
No,
it's like I grew up sports and all this.
Yeah.
And now it's like I run from that.
Yeah.
And any time the conversation ever would come up, because Bieletta's mom and stepdad have had that idea before. It's like, we should get a reality show because we're so fucking crazy and the family and business and all that. And I just can't imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, it would obviously be good for business because the exposure and the attention, but it's something that...
But you got exposure without that.
Yeah. 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 I don't know. It's like, there's very, like, you know, we always talk, Anthony Bourdain does television and there's still integrity left. But there's very few examples of that.
Isn't it funny how everybody wants that show?
Yeah,
everybody wants that show.
Well, yeah, it's incredible.
He's
a master.
He is a master
of creating and keeping his own.
He's sort of
world.
An anthropologist, sociologist. You know, he kind of.
Well, he's so fucking
brilliant.
He's very smart. He's very cultured. And he writes so well.
And he's street smart as well. So you get the whole.
He was a huge inspiration for me. Like by far, like. I mean, I loved all the great chefs, right? Jean-Georges, these guys, like back in the day, like when you're reading about everybody, Jacques Pepin, like. You know, like, you read all these books, but, like, man, the one that resonated with me the most was Anthony Bourdain's book. I remember just, like, reading it in culinary school.
I was telling Bieletta about it just yesterday, but wasn't there, like, a
Confidential, right?
Bride
That's the title?
That was getting banged on the pass at the wedding, her wedding, and the groom was,
like,
you know,
I was like, this was my childhood. Like, I was at the dumpster, like, you know, and drugs were being done there, and, like, I just resonated with him so much, and he wasn't even, like, a real chef, right? Like, he never calls himself a real chef. And then, like, you know, it's actually a massive reason why I went to Vietnam, because
he loves Vietnam. He took
it.
His daughter to Vietnam.
Yeah, he took his daughter to Vietnam. He had this huge, like, love affair with Vietnam, and that is the only reason that I said, you know what, like, I saw this opportunity to take Vietnam on and, like, go and sit there and move there and learn and open up Vietnamese restaurants. And it was really because of him. You know what I mean? Like,
tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah.
Like, Vietnam, how long were you there? And, like, how was that?
Yeah. So I was, working at I was in school and I met a chef named Michael Bao, crazy chef. They call him the architect chef in New York City. And we did all these tasting dinners at the culinary school, like fusion, Vietnamese, German, Vietnamese, Chinese. We raised money for a bunch of students to go to Vietnam. We took a bunch of students and celebrity chefs to Vietnam. I fell in love with the country. We cooked our way from north to south. And then I just eventually ended up moving there and working with Michael Bao and really kind of soaking in like the Vietnamese culture, you know, traveling all over the country. And he was teaching me his mother's food. And so I came back to New York with like a wealth of, and you have to understand, I was cooking French classic food since I, you know, forever at that time. And I was just like very bored. I kind of, not that I had learned everything I needed about French food and technique, but I was starting to plateau a little bit, like on just like the rudimentary, you know, things of French food. And I wanted like new flavors and something exotic. And Vietnam was a good fit because the French colonized Vietnam back in the day. There's a lot of French influence on the cuisine. It was something that was tangible to me. So like, I loved that whole experience. And that's kind of, you know, to this day, like, I love Vietnamese food. I go to Eden Center at least 3 times out of the week for Vietnamese coffee and a banh mi and a pho and a bun bao wei. Like I still, it's very prevalent in my life still now. But that experience was by far the best, you know, one of the greatest too. So
yeah, we would love to go to Vietnam.
Yeah,
we always talk about it, and I always hear about the street food culture, which we love about Mexico, and just the best food anywhere. And dude, always making, heard the same thing about Vietnam.
Yeah, they're making crepes like right there on Bunsen burners and alleys in Vietnam. It's just it's just so good.
Yeah.
I want to remind everyone that we are at the Dolcezza Sherber Experience on Full Service Radio. We're broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. We're talking to Spike Mendelsohn, chef, food advocate, restaurateur, celebrity, blah, blah, blah.
More like blah, 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 by the way. I would stick more to that.
Blah, blah, blah.
I have a question for you, though, really.
Okay,
quick.
Go ahead.
So, Sherbert?
Sherbert is an homage to the sherbet. You can explain,
Is sherbet gelato? Or is gelato sherbet?
Yeah, sherbet. Sherbert. That's a mystery. That was a question I was going to get into. Is like, could anybody say, I'll give a free pint to anybody that can tell me where sherbet comes from.
Ireland?
Yeah, no, I'm not saying the actual word itself.
Sherbert.
But tell us, Spike, where it comes from.
I've hooked up Spike with the strain sour banana sherbet.
Yes. I love that sherbet.
It's a nice headspace. Yeah. It ain't
but
the it's stuff you eating.
But is sherbet like a real, like
sherbet
frozen?
Sherbet is a real. It's a mix of sorbet
and
sherbet gelato.
Yeah, sherbet is the sorbet with dairy.
With a little bit of
That's
dairy.
That's what, like a sorbet has no dairy. It's like fruit, water, sugar. Essentially,
do people still do sherbet?
We really got into sherbet. Blood orange sherbet, Meyer lemon sherbet.
I love that.
Yeah, sherbet.
So good.
Sherbet's all the rage now,
dude. I love
sunset
this.
Sherbet.
I want to try some sherbet.
Uh huh. Me too.
There's something nostalgic about sherbet.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah.
You get the creaminess with the acidity of the fruit. Yeah, it's
like
good.
It. I like it.
Yeah.
So we're here in Washington D.C. and we met you here. So tell me, how did you end up here and why D.C.?
Well, I was in New York before here. Was working for about 6-7 years over there. I did the show. I went back to my Vietnamese restaurant with Drew. And I just kind of was looking for something different again. You know, like I at that time, you know, people were, you know, the idea was like, no, man, you have to stay at a restaurant and work there for 3-4 years to get somewhere, right? You have to really pay your dues in one restaurant. And I was hopping around. Like, I was doing 2 years tops at places and like leaving some really good restaurants, just hopping and going from place to place. And Top Chef, my sister, just had this idea of like taking all the marketing and PR, and she really had the vision of leveraging the stardom of what, you know, I was on the show. I didn't know what was going to happen. Like, you know, after the show, I didn't know we were going to get all these opportunities, but decided to move to D.C. to open up a burger place short term. I was just coming to help my family out, my parents. We all came from the restaurant industry together. They were just like, why don't you guys come up with a menu in New York and come over here. We'll do a tasting and we'll just have some fun. And I convinced my two guys that were working with me in New York to move to D.C. And
Coletti was one of them.
Yeah,
right?
Mike Coletti and Brian LaCaia. Yeah, those. Yeah. You know, we were all just together in South Beach for a week. We've been cooking together for probably 15 years now. But yeah, so they moved down. We launched this, and we had lines around the corner forever.
So being on Top Chef did really, you saw a huge difference before and after as far as exposure.
Massive. Massive. For me, Top Chef was very new. Well, for everyone, Top Chef was very new. And so like from the third to fourth season right there, you started to see the industry really start to accept it as like a real thing, where maybe season one or two are like, what are these guys doing? Like, you know, like. So, like, you start to see real talent, real chefs. Not that season one and two didn't have real talent, real chefs, but it wasn't like not everyone was watching this show. And so you start to see all big dogs come on the show. And
then they would leave and open their own restaurant.
Open up their own restaurant. Legit, yeah, cooks. Legit. You know, I remember my sister blew up a huge picture of my face, you know, that said Top Chef Bravo and put it, like, outside the window of like the First Good Stuff Eatery for months before we opened, and people would just walk by and be like, oh, I like Top Chef.
The big hit.
Yeah, it was just like such a smart thing. And you know, we just opened up with a huge splash.
And if I remember correctly, was this during the first term of Obama?
Yeah. We opened maybe 3-4 weeks before his inauguration, actually.
And then you did the press Obama burger, and then Michelle melted, and then they visited, they ate at your places several times, right?
Yeah.
They've never been to the Dolcezza. I'm deeply jealous, by the way.
How is that? They're supposedly like gelato fans. What's up?
What is up with that?
So call them right now.
Legit. Yeah.
We should spend at least 5 minutes right now just talking about how they haven't
gone. Obama, come to gelato.
Obama, listen, if you come out with a sherbet, and name it after Obama.
Well, you know, he has a past with the sherbet.
You just got to name something after them, and then they come.
Yeah, or yeah. He had a nickname for smoking dope.
Or like the like name Hawaii name of a flavor after their dog, Bo.
Bo, yeah, the Portuguese water dog flavor. Yeah, dog biscuit gelato. Yeah.
Did you actually spend time with them, or they were just on lunch break and then they went back to work? They were like, "Hey, give me a burger."
Yeah. So you want the story I tell people or the real
I
one?
Want the real shit. I want the real shit.
Yeah, yeah.
No, so, I mean, you know, the whole thing with the first family for us was, I mean, again, we didn't expect any of it. Or, you know, we went to the Easter egg roll. We met one of the chefs there. We heard about Michelle Obama's initiative to go, you know, the chefs to schools and reforming school lunch and making it healthier and more school farm, gardens and all that kind of stuff. So she kind of gathered like a nice group of chefs in the D.C. area, about 20 of us at the time. And we all kind of met and started talking about our objectives. And I feel like that's kind of what led the really amazing chef movement here that, you know, we saw like, you know, all these chefs want to get into policy in D.C. and get to these schools. So, you know, there's, you know, that's, I feel like that's how it started. And then I think she supported a lot of people in D.C. I think they went out to eat a lot. They made the D.C. culture of eating and, you know, celebrating food and making it important. They made that cool, right? They really kind of, I feel.
It was huge news. I started going out.
100%.
Yeah, for
the
me.
Garden
like,
oh, yeah, the garden. Lunch.
Hey, you know, yeah. Speaking of, what's I wonder if the Trumps have continued the garden. It's like a sandbox.
She has. Melania has continued.
She's growing iceberg lettuce.
Ooh. They're growing hot dogs out of there.
How much we miss those two customers of yours.
Yes.
Barack and Michelle.
You know.
Just saying.
I have to say, anybody coming after them, you know, it's almost like, you know, following like a really good comedian or something like that, and you're next on stage, you're just like, oh,
yeah, it's
my
just
God.
They were both cool, man.
They killed it.
So cool, so smooth.
Yeah, they checked all the boxes, you know, like we were blessed to have them for 8 years. And like, listen, you can't undo all that progress, no matter who you are.
That's
you know,
what we hope.
Yeah,
you can.
Yeah, you definitely hope so. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, you hear about things in the press. You hear about this new legislation, but there is some real progress that is deep rooted.
100%
That was done in that 8 years,
yeah.
And that you don't undo.
Yeah,
there's no way you can undo that. You know,
they're trying like motherfuckers, man.
It's amazing.
They are trying from one extreme to the other.
Yeah, and they'll have their own successes of what they feel like. Oh, you know, we hit back and hit hard, and it was our turn, and this and that. But at the end of the day, you can't undo the amount. Like the giant leaps.
Well, it's already
leaps.
In the system, you know, those ideas, that openness, that approach and stuff like that. Now,
being
contrasted with what is being done now.
100%. So. Like you wouldn't have the amount of pushback and smart individuals like voicing their opinions now as much as you see that all over the news. You wouldn't have that if the Obamas hadn't led the charge on that and like tell people like, listen, you have rights and freedom of speech. And like these are the things that like we should care about. Like, we wouldn't have as much pushback on Trump if it wasn't for them. So it was, you know,
he loves burgers.
It's almost kind of like he prepared us for this.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's such a weird way. It's like, I have never heard that, but it's like definitely like this is the response to that. Like the opposite
yin and yang.
End. Yeah. It's like, and it's really the extremes of it is like really interesting.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's really, really interesting.
So I see that Michelle sort of inspired the food activism a little bit on your life. And you serve, do you still serve as chair of the Washington, D.C. Food Policy Council? Is that?
I do.
You do?
I don't know. I mean, until they fire me, I guess. But yeah. You know.
So the Food Policy Council promotes food access, food sustainability, and the local food economy. So tell me a little bit about what's your experience been like working in this government position, and do you think you were able to make a difference?
Yeah, great question. And, you know, I feel that, well, first of all, Mayor Bowser's taken food policy locally very serious and is definitely, you know, I felt this is why she reached out to me to kind of like, you know, chair the council and bring together all this already existing food policy that exists in D.C. because what people don't realize is food policy has been happening, you know, on a high level in D.C. for a long time. You know, there's people that have been working on it forever. What I think this piece of legislation has developed is kind of an umbrella for everyone to work together and share their data and share their successes and some of the troubles. And from that, we hope to initiate a new legislation to make our food system a little bit easier to maneuver through. So you know, a lot of these meetings at the Food Policy Council is like figuring out what these hurdles are that are in the way of having a very sustainable, food policy in D.C. So we work on sustainable agriculture, urban farming, small business sector and jobs, and obviously food deserts, right? And education in D.C. primarily Ward 7 and 8, where they don't have as many grocery stores. Transportation is difficult. They don't have as much education surrounded around food. And I think we are making a difference to answer, you know, like we've seen some really great strides in the Food Policy Council. It's ever evolving and it's shaping itself to be what it really needs to be. But I think it's really important. We're seeing food policies councils pop up all over the country now. And we'd like to think that the DC one eventually is going to act as a head lobbying arm for all other councils to go lobby on behalf of the farm bill.
That's the advantage of doing it in D.C.
Right.
Your front center.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So we want, you know, Lance Sadowski, which is our food policy director here in D.C., does an amazing job. And she's hosting, you know, I think a handful of other food policy directors coming up here in April to talk about the farm bill and stuff. So it's great.
Great work,
yeah.
So needed.
Yeah.
And you have, you know, Wendy burgers for $1.
I remember the school lunches that I used to eat when I grew up. Milkshakes and burgers and fries, 100%.
I remember, like, my school used to have, like, Taco Bell Tuesdays sometimes. It was a treat.
Yeah, I loved it, man.
That was a treat, yeah. You know, my whole thing was, like, how can I smuggle more tacos into my lunchbox?
Which is institutional food at its finest. Yeah. Jesus Christ.
So Spike, you it seems like you were able to create a life for you as an entrepreneur, and hopefully this allows you to live a life in your own terms. And I think we talked about this in the past, you know, this idea of, you know, a little bit of stick it to the man and, you know, live by your own rules and out of certain parameters, so and the freedom that brings to your life. So how important is this to you, and how conscious, you know, were those choices?
Yeah, you know, for me, I never really loved working for anyone. I mean, even my own family is at times, you know, like, but, it, you know, so I always, and my number one passion in life is travel and culture. So, and the means for me to get there was through food, and they just go very well together, obviously. And so food and becoming a chef is kind of what afforded me the opportunity to travel all over the world and experience so many different cultures. And I love that. You know, that's kind of what I love to do. And then I'm very fortunate to also have a, you know, my family happens to be in the restaurant business. You know, so I definitely am very fortunate to have them in my life, and we can do business together. And this, you know, allows me to work on a ton of other stuff that I love working on, you know, whether it be, you know, film or other, you know, consulting other projects or what have you. But it's really all meant to let me have the wiggle room to travel when I want to. You guys know how it is. You want to go with the family to, you know, to go experience something, and you schedule it, right? Yeah. And you make it work for yourself. And, you know, of course, when you're gone, it's not like you're, you know, everything's being treated the same, you know, so you know, but you have the liberty to do that. And what can be better than having the liberty to do that?
It's about the priority as far as how important that is. What is your, I know we've talked about it maybe before, but what is your dream scenario as far as, like, okay, if you have that, like, this is kind of what I'm trying to fix or arrange for me to be able to live this way in this place, etc.
Yeah, I mean, my dream scenario would be to, like, continue doing what I'm doing, because I could travel and work remotely thanks to technology and be pretty efficient at it if you do it right. But my dream is, like, to have, like, you know, maybe 3 residences of sorts, like, in the nice little pockets, that, like, nothing huge. Like, you know, I don't need big house. Like, I can live in this radio room right now. It's so cool. You know, like, my bed's in there. Like, you know, like, I can live.
Spike is moving in.
I can live here. You know, like, I'm sorry.
Jack.
As long as you can cook.
I got the coffee bar across. Like, it's great. But, you know, like, you know, I love Hawaii. I love surfing. I always imagine to be there. My wife loves Utah and the mountains. So, you know, I'd be able to bounce back from DC to probably, like, somewhere in the mountains, Utah, and the ocean. And I mean, that's all I really need, a couple trips a year to wherever we want to go. And that's it. I'm not, like, you know, I'm not too greedy. I just want to, you know, I definitely want to keep experiencing different cultures and countries, as well as, like, being able to be somewhat bi-coastal. So it's a big dream, you know, and it fits my personality. I'm not knocking the 9-to-5s, you know, that's what people, you know, do, you know, in their lives. That's what they want to do, and they figure out, you know,
each to their own.
There's a lot of benefits from 100%. A 9-to-5 job, you know, like, for instance,
it's
every
easier.
Weekend
stability,
you know, like, yeah,
yeah, weekends,
there's a lot of cool stuff. It's just
on the other hand, it can be alienating too, the 9-to-5. I think the search for freedom has some sort of, you know, like,
it was never for me, you know, the 9-to-5. It's just,
yeah,
we'd never,
but
felt,
I mean,
it
more
either.
Important, I think it's so more important too, or just as important as, like, whether it's 9-to-5 or it's your own gig, is, like, do you like it? That's the thing.
Yeah,
you
have to love it.
I mean, because if you like it and it's 9-to-5 and it has all the benefits and stuff and you're happy, that's kind of what the most important thing is. Not if it's like your own job or your own business.
And this may sound weird too, but I never really loved, like, organizing my life as such that, like, I never liked the idea, like, in my head that I was working a 9-to-5 job, because I don't look at time really as that relevant or important. Like, I don't love to look at that as much and, like, have it dictate, like, what part of my day is being spent. I like to be able to be inspired to spend time on this or spend time on that or what have you.
When I was a teenager in high school and on an acid trip, I had a watch on, and I kept every 5 minutes looking at my watch, just randomly, and I know, and I threw out my watch after that trip, and I never had a it watch never, on in my life because of that, because of this whole abstract notion of arranging yourself at noon. I must be hungry.
The lessons from shrooms, my friend.
Exactly, man. Lots listen of to valuable the plants. Lessons.
Listen to the plants.
The monkeys are out of control on the planet. We must listen.
We have to listen to the plants. But we're becoming a plant eating culture.
Well, but look at cannabis being legalized. Do you know all the psychedelic research right now?
Yeah.
Mushrooms, DMT, LSD,
MDMA.
I mean, right now more than ever, NYU, Johns Hopkins, UCLA, more than ever, there's legit scientific research being done on these plants and the effects of consciousness. And I mean, to me, my life, my experiences, no person, no institution, no business, no church, no parent, no peer, no motherfucker has ever given me better advice of what's important on this planet than a plant. And I'm not joking. No facetiousness whatsoever.
I love
this. It's for real.
Amen to the plants.
Amen to the plants.
Gather around.
Well, guys, this is lovely.
Yeah, we can go deep and far fast.
No, our time is up.
Oh, that's quick.
Wah, 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 wah.
Yeah.
But I want to thank you so much for being with us today, Spike. And I want to thank all of our listeners out there. And if you want to find out more about Spike or you want to listen to this interview again.
Good stuff, Eatery.
Oh, you want? Yeah, go and have a burger.
Thank you, Spike. We love you.
But yeah, everything
is... Pass it around.
Pass a burger around to the left. A
little more pickle with it.
Anyway, I was going to say that everything is on the Full Service Radio website, at fullserviceradio.org. Until next time, everyone, try to be kind to one another. Peace.
See you at the dumpster.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts, covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.